The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My tendency is to convict Rhodes on seditious conspiracy. There's just overwhelming evidence of his palaver in that vein. He's calling for civil war, bloody revolution, and that continues even after January 6th. He spends another $20,000 on firearms between January 6th and January 20th, when he's back in Texas. And at least one, and I don't know if the jurors will understand this, but at least one of the co-conspirators who's not indicted, named Joshua James, goes back to Texas with him. And so I think the conspiracy continues with Joshua James, and I would convict him of that.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 23rd, 2022. For the last 29 days, Roger Parloff, Lawfare senior editor, has been sitting in on the Oathkeeper trial in Washington. You may have seen his live tweeting. It has been among the very best coverage of the trial. But the trial is now done, the jury has the case, and Roger joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about the whole case. Which charges are likely to stick? Which ones seem weak? How did the various defendants do when they took the stand to defend themselves? And what kind of verdict do we expect when the jury eventually comes back? It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 23rd, Roger Parloff with Oathkeeper closing arguments. So Roger, let's start with, for those who haven't listened to any of our prior Oathkeepers updates or podcasts, now that it has gone to the jury, just give us the briefest of overviews of what this trial is about and who the defendants are.
Yeah. Remember, the Oathkeepers were the group that became a sort of a symbol of the insurrection. They are the paramilitary group that scaled the East Capitol steps at some point, and you can see the crowd sort of parting for them, and they're all in military uniform. They all have their right hand on the right shoulder of the cadre in front of them, and they go up the steps and into the Capitol.
And just to be clear, that's the way we move at Lawfare, right? Whenever the group of us go somewhere, it's always in stack formation in military outfits.
As you insist.
Correct.
Yeah. And so on its face, that looked conspiratorial to those that of a skeptical eye. And in addition, it turned out that they had an arsenal across the river at the Comfort Inn in Ballston, which is Arlington County, about 10 minutes away, and several arsenals, in fact, and they had another in Vienna, Virginia. So all of that looked suspicious, and they have been charged. About 25 Oathkeepers have been charged, but the five involved in this case are sort of the creme de la creme as the prosecutors look at them, and they're considered leaders, and they were charged with seditious conspiracy. About 12 Oath Keepers were charged with seditious conspiracy. 3 pled guilty, and 9 are in this indictment, but the U.S. courthouse in D.C. doesn't have a court that can accommodate 9 defendants, so the first 5 are on trial.
And they are charged with seditious conspiracy, among other charges. What are the lesser charges? And how much of what turned out to be a very long trial did you sit through?
I'll answer the second part first. I sat through all but about 2 hours of cross-examination of one FBI agent. So I saw a lot of it. It was 29 days. And I also saw some of the jury selection. But there are 10 counts, and there are 5 defendants. All 5 are charged with 3 conspiracies: seditious conspiracy, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy to prevent congressmen from discharging their duties. And then all 5 are also charged with the substantive count of corruptly obstructing an official proceeding, either directly or aiding and abetting. All 5 are charged with destruction of federal property as a felony, and that's also by aiding and abetting. That has to do mainly with the front doors on the East Capitol's east doors, the East Rotunda doors and the Columbus doors, which suffered damage in the attacks that day. And one defendant, Jessica Watkins, is charged with impeding police officers during a civil disorder. That's not quite assaulting police officers, but it's close. It's sort of, she participated in a mob scene inside one of the corridors leading to the Senate chamber, where the mob tried to push past a battalion of riot police. And then finally, 4 of the 5 are charged with sort of conventional obstruction of justice by deleting files from their phones.
So you have now watched the entire trial, including the presentation of the prosecution's case, the presentation of the defense, and the closing arguments. Before I ask you the key question of the entire episode, which is, how would you vote if you were a juror? I want to remind the audience, we've talked about this before, about what the essential defense is, because the defendants don't deny that they ran into the Capitol in stack formation in an imitation of the way lawfare personnel move. They don't deny that there was a lot of texting that sounds kind of at least adjacent to seditious conspiracy. And they don't deny that there was a large cache of weapons across the river in Virginia. So before we go into who in juror Parloff's mind should prevail in this case, remind us what the defense looks like here.
The key defense is no plan, and therefore no conspiracy. And that is a non-trivial defense. It's surprising, but it's basically conceded that there was never, for instance, any plan about, any concrete plan, how were they going to stop Biden from taking power? How were they going to stop the certification of the election? There was a lot of very specific, seditious, we can say that unquestionably, talk in their signal chat. You know, we need to stop Biden from taking power. He's a Chinese communist puppet. Our lives will be over if he takes power. But there's never any plan about how they're going to do that. And that leaves them open to a credible claim that these are just old guys venting. This is hyperbole. This is bravado. But There's no plan. And that's a difficult question. And of course, what happens on January 6th is other people, other rioters, the Proud Boys and others, breach the Capitol. And then there they are. They're on a security, you know, they do these personal security details. That's ostensibly what they do. They protect people like, you know, General Flynn and Roger Stone and Alex Jones and lesser people. And they protect, you know, the crowd members from Antifa, who they claim, you know, comes out at night and hurts Trump supporters as they try to return to their hotels. So they're there. And then, you know, somebody else breaches the Capitol, and they, like 900 other people that day, decide to go in. And, you know, some say, well, we were hoping to help the police, you know, if there were any problems. So that's sort of the defense. And it turns out it's not a non-trivial defense. You know, the government will say, look, read the jury instructions. We don't need a plan, a specific plan. All we need is a mutual understanding and a meeting of the minds. The meeting of the minds was to prevent Biden from taking power. The opportunity presented itself January 6th, and they took it. It was obvious, and they took it.
All right. So this is the kind of Proud Boys made me do it defense. It only really applies to the seditious conspiracy case or to the other conspiracies alleged, but not to the presence or to the, you know, sort of lower level charging into the Capitol when you're not supposed to be there to obstruct an official proceeding. Are they effectively conceding guilt on those charges?
No. Of course, Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers, does not go inside the Capitol. He's out front. And he claims he never gave an order for them to go in. And if you can't get him on conspiracy, then you can't get him on the other things, except destroying documents from his phone. A couple of the defendants claim, Jessica Watkins and Tom Caldwell, that when they heard that Pence had betrayed us on the, you know, when people, they heard that in Twitter or various places, they thought that meant the certification had already occurred. So they weren't trying to obstruct the certification. They thought it had already happened. They just went into the Capitol to make their voices heard. So that's their position. Remember that if it's not for the purpose of stopping the proceeding, or delaying the proceeding, is just trespassing. And they're not really charged with that. That would be the lesser misdemeanor, because at least four of the five are detained and they've already served more than a year. So a misdemeanor would be meaningless at this point. So no, they're trying to avoid the others. One defendant, Jessica Watkins, the one that for which there is rock crusher evidence that she was impeding the police officers. You have video, you have audio of her saying, push, 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 get in there, they can't hold us. And then you have video of her going up against the riot police, and then you have the riot police body-worn camera video of what that was like. She has admitted on the stand that, yes, she's guilty of that charge. That's the only charge anyone has admitted.
All right, so now let's talk to Juror Parloff, who attended the proceedings the whole way through and is very similar to you in all respects, except that he didn't hear any of the arguments or material not presented to the jury. He didn't hear anything except what the judge let the jury hear. What does Roger, you know, obviously he goes into the deliberations with an open mind, and there are 11 other jurors who might persuade him of things. But what are his instincts going into deliberations about which charges he is inclined to convict on and not convict on, based entirely on the evidence as presented and the instructions from the judge, not considering any prejudicial feelings he may have had going in, because the judge instructed him to consider only the material presented in court?
Yeah, I would probably acquit all of them on the destruction of federal property. None of them touched the East Rotunda doors. None of them touched the Columbus doors. At least there was no proof. Even on an aiding and abetting theory, I think that one you probably can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt. My tendency is to convict Rhodes on seditious conspiracy. There's just overwhelming evidence of his palaver in that vein, calling for civil war, bloody revolution, and that continues even after January 6th. He spends another $20,000 on firearms between January 6th and January 20th, when he's back in Texas. And at least one, and I don't know if the jurors will understand this, but at least one of the co-conspirators who's not indicted, named Joshua James, goes back to Texas with him. And so I think the conspiracy continues with Joshua James, and I would convict him of that. In addition, he took the stand, and I would say that the cross-examination by Assistant U.S. Attorney Catherine Mercozzi was devastating. I would say it demolished him.
What other charges do you have strong feelings about what you would do as a juror?
I would say that the two toughest defendants are a guy named Ken Harrelson and a guy named Tom Caldwell. Ken Harrelson was not... Most of this case is built on signal chat messages. The Oath Keepers used multiple channels of this end-to-end encrypted app called Signal. And when they were, when their phones were seized, in most cases, in many cases, these apps were still on their phone and they could recover a lot of these messages. And that's how the case is built. Ken Harrelson didn't have that. And he wasn't on Twitter. He wasn't on Facebook. He wasn't on Parler. And so there's very little of him ranting and raving. And so he has a good chance of getting off. He did go into the Capitol, but even so, I don't know if you can prove the conspiracies. The other guy is Tom Caldwell. He doesn't go into the Capitol. He's 65. He's a Navy veteran colonel, and he's 100% service-related disability, and he is a maniacal talker, storyteller, and he is constantly lying in all forms of social media to his friends, saying incriminating things that he didn't really do, pretending that he went into the Capitol, pretending that he, all of these things that physically he's not really capable of doing. And so, to some extent that fooled the FBI. Now, there are some things he really did, but still, I think he has a chance. And he was not technically an Oath Keeper. He was just an affiliate. And so he wasn't on the signal chat. So for those reasons, he has a chance of getting off too.
So you're thinking, you're really expecting a mixed verdict.
Yeah, very much so.
Interesting.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is delete me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare 20. All right. Let's talk about the defendants who took the stand. There are three of them. How'd they do? You already said Rhodes's cross was devastating. So let's start there. How did Rhodes damage himself?
So Rhodes on direct portrayed himself as something of a constitutional scholar. He went to Yale Law School. He won a prize there. He did not mention that he was later disbarred, but that's okay. And then he explained that he had constitutional issues with the way the 2020 election proceeded. He thought it was in violation of the clause of the Constitution that gives power to the state legislatures to decide how the elections will be run because of all the adaptations made for COVID by non-legislators. So he also explained that as a constitutional scholar, he believed that Trump had the power to invoke the Insurrection Act in order to prevent this fraudulent election from proceeding, and that that was basically an unreviewable power, and that he was empowered to call up the Oath Keepers as an unorganized militia to fight on his behalf, hence the QRF over at the Comfort Inn, the Quick Reaction Force, the arsenal. He also testified that he, on January 6th, he was just minding his own business, doing the personal security details, and he never ordered anyone into the Capitol. And afterwards, when he found out they had gone into the Capitol, he said that that was stupid because that would give their political enemies an opportunity to come after him. And sure enough, that's where we are, as he put it. After direct, and all of this gets very subjective, you know, my personal reaction to his direct even was that I put it on Twitter. I said he reminded me of someone trying to pick up a 17-year-old in a bar. And what I meant was he was macho. He was self-aggrandizing. There were a lot of unverifiable self-promotional anecdotes. I will note that his son, Dakota, then quote tweeted me on Twitter and said, quote, "This is the most accurate assessment of Stewart I have ever heard." So I appreciated that.
That's very funny. Does he have a bad relationship with his son, or does his son approve of picking up 17-year-olds in bars?
He seems to have an estranged relationship with his father, Dakota and Stewart. And then on cross, it really got worse, because it was very obvious that his qualms with the election were not just abstract issues of constitutionality. He believed in the wildest and most preposterous of fraudulent electional denial theories. He propagated those. I don't know if you've even heard of Hammer and Scorecard, but that's this CIA supercomputer that changes votes. He was very much into QAnon. He talked about, he wanted Trump to declassify files so that we could expose the pedophiles at the CIA. He continually called Biden a Chi-Com puppet, meaning Chinese communist puppet. And then when it got to all of the seditious ranting in the Signal chat, his defense was that, well, he was talking about the future context, not to prevent the inauguration, but what would happen after the inauguration. And so it was very much tied to the indictment. You know, the indictment charges a conspiracy between November and January. And he was saying, no, it was actually the Civil War would begin a little later. And Roccozzi, the prosecutor, brought this out. And these are my notes, of course. I don't have the transcript. But she said, so the Civil War would be on January 21st and not January 6th, to which he responded, well, not necessarily. And you see, that to me, you're really on the defensive at that point when you're conceding that you were advising taking up arms against the United States.
You're just quibbling over the date at that point.
Exactly, exactly. He admitted down the road, we'd have no chance to fight if Trump left office without fixing this. So Roccozzi said, you're talking about a call to arms to keep Trump in power. And Rhodes said, I wouldn't want to characterize it like that. So I thought these were pretty damaging exchanges. One thing that was sort of a side point, but also not great with the jury, was she brought out the fact that, you know, he was maligning Mitch McConnell. And she said, you couldn't trust Mitch McConnell because his wife was Chinese. And Rhodes said, in part, yes.
Yeah, that's probably not something you want to say in front of the jury.
No. And so he had gone to great lengths to explain that the Oath Keepers were a highly diverse group. There was no racism. There was no this or that. I think that undercut that message. The other thing that he had to contend with was there was some evidence, circumstantial evidence, that he may have ordered Meggs into the Kelly Meggs is the second most important defendant, I would say. He led the Florida Oath Keepers. He leads this 14-person stack into the Capitol. And there was some circumstantial evidence that Rhodes might have given him an order. And the way that works is this. At 2:31 p.m., the Oath Keeper that's called the operations leader, Michael Green, calls Rhodes. At 2:32 p.m., while they're on the phone, Meggs also calls Rhodes. And then 9 seconds later, Rhodes merges the two calls. And so for the next 90 seconds, you have three Oath Keepers on the phone, 2:32 to 2:33. And then Meggs gets off the phone, and 2 minutes later, he leads 14 Oath Keepers into the Capitol, 2:35. So that looks like Rhodes gave an order, go into the Capitol. And on direct, Rhodes did not address this call at all. On cross, he said, well, you know, it was very loud and I could never hear Meggs. And so that raises the question, so you couldn't hear him and yet you merged the calls? And he said, yeah, you know, well, I was hoping that maybe the call would improve. And then you're on him for 90, with him for 90 seconds and you can't hear him. It's like, hello, Kelly, Kelly, hello, hello. And that all strained credulity for me. But so I think in those respects, he did not help himself.
What about the other two who testified?
They were very interesting. Jessica Watkins was this woman that she was dead to rights on the impeding charge. So she told a very sympathetic story to anybody, but I think especially to a DC jury. She is a trans female. So she was in the army. Somebody found out that she was considering transitioning. It was during the don't ask, don't tell period. He confronted her, called her the F word, the longer F word. She was afraid of getting killed. She went AWOL for a couple months in Alaska. And then she turned herself in. She was other than honorably discharged, was how her lawyer brought it out. She was rejected by her parents. She didn't fit in with the trans community, which she found touchy-feely. And, you know, she was still, this is an interesting thing, you know, she was still a macho right-wing, and she formed her own militia. You can see her not fitting in with many trans communities. And she also hated herself, she said. And so she wanted to put herself in harm's way so that she would die, but it die in doing something meaningful. And so she formed this militia to help with, you know, hurricane relief and various good causes. And then she admitted the count six, the impeding charge, which she sort of had to. And she said she was one of the ones who said that when she'd heard that Pence had betrayed us, she thought that meant the certification was done with. And so she couldn't have conspired to do any of these things, to have stopped the certification.
So I don't understand. All of this sounds pretty inculpatory, except with respect to that last point. It's more, I did it because I'm you know, trans and was mistreated and was upset. Not, I mean, maybe it's an ameliorative factor, but it doesn't seem like it gets you to acquittal, right?
Well, she's conceding the impeding charge, which is a 5-year max, but she's contesting the conspiracies, which are 20-year max. And if she's right about, you know, if she's telling the truth about, I thought the certification was completed when they said Pence had betrayed us, then, that might help her. Things got weirder on cross because she had said things like in her writings, she was recruiting for her own militia as well as for the Oath Keepers. And she would say things like, I need to get you fighting fit by inauguration. And so, sort of like Rhodes, she defended that by saying, well, I wasn't talking about preventing inauguration. It was after inauguration when we would have to fight. And then things get really weird.
Right, because once you say that, you're saying the seditious conspiracy I was involved in wasn't to prevent the inauguration. It was a much broader, longer-term seditious conspiracy than that.
That's right. And also there's a flip to it with her, which is this, and I doubt many readers are or listeners are expecting this, but she thought that, you know, once Biden took power, he would impose mandatory COVID vaccines. And federal officials would refuse to enforce those. And so Biden would call in United Nations troops to enforce his COVID agenda. And she was preparing to fight the UN troops. So she's not preparing to go up against the United States troops. She's preparing to go up against the Biden allied and called in United Nations troops. That's one theory. And she said she's thought that scenario had a 1 in 4 chance of occurring. Scenario 2 was that the Chinese were going to have a joint military exercise with the Canadians on the Canadian border with 80 to 90,000 Chinese troops on the Canadian border. And she was afraid they would invade into Chicago or across the Niagara River. And she said these scenarios were being described on right-wing media, and she thought there was a 50-50 chance of this scenario. So again, she would be fighting the Chinese, not the United States. So you have that. There was also another problem that once she decided to testify, and incidentally, I don't think her lawyer wanted her to testify. I think her lawyer was quite surprised when at the last minute she insisted on testifying. And it ended up there were some things she had told the FBI when she was in custody and when she was trying to negotiate, you know, maybe she was proffering, she wanted to maybe get a favorable guilty plea. And she said a couple of things, one of which hurt her and one of which hurt Kelly Meigs, a co-defendant. She said, well, first of all, she had never told the FBI this theory that she thought the certification had already occurred, so which was her main defense. Another thing is she had said that as soon as she got in the stack that day, she knew they were going in to the Capitol. She knew they had the numbers and the force people to force their way in. So that incidentally is sufficient. You know, a conspiracy can be, you can join a conspiracy late in the game. It doesn't have to be premeditated. So that was damaging to her as far as at least the conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding and to prevent the congressman from discharging their duties or to force the congressman away from the place where they need to perform their duties. That's part of that third conspiracy statute. She also incriminated her co-defendant Meigs to the FBI because she remembered him saying afterwards, "We stormed the Capitol, we're standing firm, and we're going to hold the Capitol all night," which sounds pretty incriminating and I think conspiratorial. The third guy was this guy, Tom Caldwell, who's the one that tells a lot of weird stories. On direct, he talked about his physical problems and, you know, he has a back problem. He usually walks with a cane. He has some fused vertebrae, full disability. And he broke down crying at the end, talking about when he was arrested and he was afraid the FBI was going to shoot his wife. And so that might have done him some good. He too took the position that when he heard Pence had betrayed us, he thought the certification was done and gone. On cross, he had a lot of problems with the things he had said and his wife had said. He was on the west side of the Capitol outside, but he got all the way up to on top of the inaugural scaffolding, which is pretty far to go without. He did not have a cane that day. And he said, "Well, I take oxymorphone, the opioid, and I took a double dose and I was able to do all this." And his wife at the on the top, they made a videos and his wife had done a video and said, "Congress is gone because they are pussies." And so to begin with, that sounds like they understood Congress had fled, not that they were done, that they had fled because they had been driven out. They had been evacuated. And then she said, "We've gone through tear gas and smoke bombs and rubber bullets, and we're here." So it sounded like she understood violence was going on. She said, he and her, she testified also, they said, "Well, we heard that in the crowd. We didn't witness any violence ourselves." And then later, you know, that evening on January 6th, 7:38 p.m., he wrote to all of his friends back in Virginia, and he said, "Sharon and I roll," and of course, this is where he clearly is embellishing, but still, it does not sound very remorseful. And by 7:38 p.m., people knew what had happened on January 6th. She said, "Sharon and I rolled with the Oath Keepers. Cops out of nowhere started throwing flashbangs and tear gas to kids' group. Then we heard Pence fucked us. Then the lying media said Trump supporters were breaking through the barricades. So I said, if we're going to get blamed, might as well do it. So I grabbed my American flag and said, let's take the damn Capitol. So people started surging forward and climbing the scaffolding outside. So I said, let's storm the place and hang the traitors. People in front of me broke through the doors and started duking it out with the pigs who broke and ran. Then we started stealing the cops' riot shields and throwing fire extinguishers through windows. It was a great time." So a lot of those details are true, of course, in terms of what did happen that day. It's not necessarily true he was doing them, but it sounds like they were pretty close. They might have understood there was violence at the time. And at that point, he actually began to say things that were so implausible that it's hard to tell what he was doing. I thought he was lying in a defiant way, in a way as to say, "F you, prosecutors. F you, this whole sham legal system." Because he began to, you know, they would ask him about these and he'd say, "Well, what I meant was it was a new beginning. What I meant was it was a time for healing." And it was just puzzling what he was doing at that point.
Yeah, when I said it was a great day, we pushed the pigs back and they fled, what I meant is it's a new beginning and a time for healing.
Yeah, so it was really, I thought it was pretty bad for him. Now, I still think the evidence against him is not strong, and you can sort of not like him or his wife and still think maybe there's not a proof beyond a reasonable doubt. One last example of this, and it's sort of peripheral, but a friend that night, 2 days later, a friend sent him that video we all saw, remember the demonstrators heckling Lindsey Graham at the airport? A couple days later, they were calling him a traitor because he had voted to approve the election. And so one of his friends sent him this, and Caldwell responded saying something about, well, that basically he was getting what he deserved. We all know what happens to traitors, what they deserve, meaning alluding to execution. And so he was asked about this, and he said, the protesters were actually criticizing Graham for certain judicial appointments he'd approved, and not, it had nothing to do with the certification. So, you know, at that point, you really wondered what's going on. Was he just saying F you to the prosecutors on the stand in front of the jury? And maybe F you to the jurors. I'm not sure.
All right. Before we wrap, how were the closing arguments?
They were very good. All of the defendants hammered home the fact that there was no plan. And I think that's their defense. That's the viable defense. And you do wonder, I think I've told you before, there's a sense of, to me, of the dog that catches the car, the barking dog that runs after the car and catches it and doesn't know what to do. These guys were big talkers, talking about revolution, talking about civil war. There they are, and suddenly the Proud Boys break in. And it's sort of like, well, what do we do? And they sort of had to go in. You do wonder, with everyone except Rhodes, and maybe a second guy who wasn't charged here named Joshua James, whether they would otherwise have gone in. And so if you're steeped in these cases and, you know, you've seen 900 other people go into the Capitol, these aren't the most serious charges. You know, they don't assault the police the way a lot of these guys do. Some of them just walk around aimlessly and go out, which would be normally a misdemeanor. So that was where they focused, and I think that was the right place to focus. And then the government said, look, just believe your eyes, believe your ears. They were talking about sedition. They get the opportunity, they go in, read the jury instructions, that's sufficient.
So the jury has the case. It was a long trial. I expect your description of it sounds complicated. I expect the jury will be out for a while.
I think so. You have 10 counts, 5 defendants who are not all similarly situated. I think it's a pretty complicated thing. It's a fairly complicated jury verdict form. If they do convict on seditious conspiracy, they have to be unanimous as to which kind of seditious conspiracy. Is it opposing by force the authority of the United States? Is it using force to prevent, hinder, and delay the execution of the laws of the United States? I think it'll take a while. They'll deliberate today, Tuesday, then they will break Wednesday before Thanksgiving, come back November 28th, Monday. And I would be surprised if they have a verdict before Tuesday the 29th, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's later than that.
Well, we will have you back when they come back to chew over the verdict. Roger Parloff, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer is the one, the only Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. You know, unlike some of Ian's production teams, we're not going to be pulling this episode of the Lawfare Podcast off of Apple Podcasts. If you don't know what that refers to, I'm just going to leave it hanging there and you can go figure it out. Hey, folks, you need to do your part to support the Lawfare Podcast and support Goat Rodeo in its fight to keep its other podcasts up on line. So become a material supporter of Lawfare, which enables you to derivatively become a material supporter of Goat Rodeo. You can do that at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare Podcast's editor is Jen Patia Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.